This is Sportsnet Today, and you're on air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair. Now here are your hosts, Israel and Alex.
On Air is back for another week live for 2 hours on Sportsnet 650 every Saturday. I'm Israel Fair. I'm a staff editor at The Athletic, and I'm based in Vancouver.
And in Calgary, I'm Alex Blair, former feature producer with Hockey Night in Canada.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at Israel Fair. Alex's handle is ACPW Blair. Pretty fired up for this. On today's show, we'll talk to Richard Deitch. He's from The Athletic and Sportsnet 590, The Fan in Toronto. We'll also talk to Satyar Shah from right here, Sportsnet 650. All-day Canucks coverage heading into the first Hockey Night in Canada Saturday game for the Canucks against a familiar foe, at least a lot of familiar guys on the other side of the ice in the Calgary Flames. So keep it locked to Sportsnet 650 all day for all-day Canucks coverage until right through the post-game show. Before we can do any of that, let's do our headlines, Alex.
There's a lot this week, Izzy. We got some breaking news in the world of tennis as well, but we've got the James Harden trade in Brooklyn. We've got four big NFL games. The NHL kicked off this week. Where do you want to start?
Let's start with the Canucks coming off of their first two games of the season, a back-to-back with the Edmonton Oilers. I think we saw the two sides of this team that we are expecting. In the first game, we saw the offense look really good. We saw Bo Horvat really pick up right where he left off in the playoffs. And in the second game, and yes, Connor McDavid was the one that was doing most of the damage, and he's going to do that against some of the better defensive teams in the league. So it's not necessarily a huge concern, but there were some moments even in the first game where the Canucks defensively looked a little bit lacking, though I don't think anyone would blame the goaltending. I think the goaltending was pretty solid in both games as well. So we saw both sides of the Canucks in the win on Wednesday and the loss on Thursday. What were your early impressions of what we saw from this team?
To be honest, not really surprised. I think a couple things. Without any preseason games, I think it's going to take all of the teams, you know, 3 to 5 games to sort of get up to speed a little bit. I think you could notice specifically in the second game the significance of JT Miller not being in the lineup. And, you know, it was funny. I was talking to somebody this morning. It's still unclear, based on sort of COVID protocols and the British Columbia sort of health administration, when JT can return. From what I understand, the best case scenario is he could return next Wednesday versus Montreal when the Canucks return home.
Right.
So that would have him missing the next two games. Yep. Worst case scenario is he would have to sit the full 14-day quarantine, and that would have him not returning until Monday the 25th. So just over a week from now, that's missing 5 games. He'd return against Ottawa again at home. But you can see, and we talked about this last week about Nils Höglander and how important his emergence in training camp was, but you know, that set up the second line, but you take JT Miller off that first line and it sort of shifts everyone down the lineup. You know, you're trying to figure out who to play with Petey and with Besser, I thought Travis Hamonic looked a little soft in the first game, but I mean, the guy hasn't played in almost a year.
Yep.
But I agree with you. I didn't think that Demko was a concern in the second game at all. If anything, I just sort of thought the Canucks were still, you know, kind of feeling themselves out a little bit. It's funny, the power play was 0-for-11 through the two games, but I actually didn't think it looked, you know, they had a ton of possession and they seemed to move the puck around well. It was more trying to set up where the shot was going to come from. I don't know what you thought about the power play because the numbers didn't look good, but I think the eye test was a lot different than the numbers revealed.
Yeah, I'm there too. And I think obviously Miller's absence is going to have an impact there too. He's someone that makes a lot of those small plays in those hard areas, you know, those areas, not necessarily net front and not necessarily as a bumper, but sort of somewhere in between. And he does a really nice job of weaving in and out of those spaces and setting up those types of plays. So when you lose a player like him, especially the leadership qualities that he brings and so on and so forth, at 5-on-5, I think you're absolutely right. When you look at the depth of this team, for as exciting as Nils Höglander he's excited Canucks fans for sure, and was pretty good in the first game. Obviously got a goal. That was a cool moment. But you'd like him to be a little bit more of an X factor than a player that the Canucks have to rely on. And then when the first line, if we're going to call it that, with Elias Pettersson and Brock Besser, when they have to move things around, when Besser has to play on his off wing, you're not maximizing what you have. And that speaks a little bit to the concerns that I have about the Canucks long-term this season. Obviously, after the first game, I felt, well, okay, if they're going to score like this, then maybe I have underestimated them. Maybe they are a little bit closer to the playoff team that that I didn't predict them to be. That said, we did see them against teams, and the Oilers were, it's funny, right? Like, we think the Oilers are not a good defensive team overall, and there are definitely questions about their goaltending. However, they have made slight improvements over the last couple of years, but they're improving from almost total disaster to okay or middling. So they're not a standout defensive team. I don't know if there's really a team in the Canadian division. Maybe it's the team the Canucks play tonight in Calgary that's going to have a little bit more of that. And probably outside of Connor Hellebuck in the Canadian division, Jacob Markstrom would be the goaltender that inspires the most confidence. Mm-hmm. That said, I do think that this is going to be an ups and downs season. There's going to be some opportunities for some of the depth players to step up. We've seen it early here with Jake Virtanen getting a chance to play with Pettersson and Besser. So far, that hasn't made much of an impact. It is still only a couple of games, but anything else over the first couple of days of the season caught your eye? We've got all the Canadian teams have played at this point. Obviously, today, Saturday, it's a loaded slate for Hockey Night in Canada. So
yeah, we got 10 games around the league tonight, yeah. Three of which on Hockey Night in Canada. We've got the Leafs Senators, and actually I'll go there because one of the things I thought was interesting on night one, and you saw that the impact of Hoglander, it changed the dynamic of that second line with Bo Horvat, and all of a sudden they looked offensively threatening. They were putting pressure on Edmonton's D in the offensive zone, and I thought it was really interesting because I think so often we look at the top lines, you look at the best players in the Canadian division, whether it be, you know, Mark Scheifele in Winnipeg, Austin Matthews in Toronto, Pettersson in Vancouver, or McDavid in Edmonton. But really off, you know, a lot of times it's that second line because you go power on power. I don't want to say they cancel each other out, but it's that depth. And that's an area the Canucks have lacked. You know, they've been looking for a player that can help Bo offensively. And Hoglander really did that on night one. And the same thing happened in Toronto, where they have Tavares on the second line now. And Tavares was able to put up some numbers on that first night as well. And I just thought it was a good example of how important the second line depth offensively is going to be in the Canadian division. But if you look ahead to tonight, that is going to be a interesting matchup after the Leafs lost last night and lost fairly decisively. And a week ago, we were talking about how many people predicted that the Leafs were going to be, they were the strong team in this Canadian North.
By far, that was everyone's pick.
Yeah, and the Senators were seen as the one weak team. And, you know, we're not even a week into the season, and the Senators went out there and dismantled the Leafs. And it was notable, you know, like I'm looking here, TJ Brody, who's the new acquisition on the defense, Austin Matthews, Wayne Simmonds, all -3 last night, you know, and I know we talk about Quinn Hughes a lot, and you know Cale Makar gets a lot of attention as sort of as part of this young D core going forward, and sort of talks about potential Norris Trophy. You know who flies under the radar a lot is Thomas Chabot, and Thomas Chabot played.
And he already got paid too. He's got his contract. He's locked up.
They locked him up at a fairly good number for Ottawa. He was +4 last night. And he was playing big minutes. He played just under 30 minutes. He played almost 10 minutes more than any other player on the Senators roster.
He did that a lot last year, too. He was playing.
Yeah, he's going up against limits. Yeah, and look at Toronto's roster. That is a, you know, offensively, they have a ton of firepower. So Thomas Chabot is quietly, you know, establishing himself as one of, like, the premier defensemen in the league. He doesn't have a ton of support around him, so it'll be interesting to see whether he can keep that up. But things are going to get interesting in Toronto. Kyle Dubas,
yes, they are.
Yeah, like, you know, even the first night, they got a little lucky on the tying goal where the referee kind of got in the way.
Yeah.
And then the Leafs end up winning it in a fairly sort of wide open overtime. But Kyle Dubas looked uncharacteristically tense. And I think that they are feeling the pressure. And I think we all thought that if this year didn't go well, that maybe, you know, Kyle would be in trouble. But after that loss last night and the way they looked on the opening night, they just look, you know, something's off. And granted, let's give them five games. Let's see how they get going here. But that could be something to watch, because if this team does not get off to, you know, the start that they had hoped with the sort of the new division that was supposed to open some doors for them on their path to the playoffs. Yeah, it's interesting. We've talked about how difficult it'll be to make trades, but I wonder how difficult it is to, you know, bring in a new GM, like, you know, administrative changes during, right, you know, especially across the border. What stood out to you? What other games, what other teams did you see that kind of caught your eye this first week?
Well, I mean, I think we saw Sidney Crosby in the first couple of games look like Sidney Crosby. And when I look at the totality of his career, you know, obviously a huge ascent from probably as hyped a prospect as we'd seen in, I probably since Mario Lemieux, I guess Eric Lindros. So 15 years, and delivered on it pretty much immediately. Delivers a Stanley Cup within the first 5 years. You know, it's all going well. Then there's that lull with the injuries where he misses a lot of time. And the thing that's crazy is when you look at his numbers from those injury shortened years, they're his best years from like a points per game perspective. Like he was in his age prime and he was unbelievable, but there was that lull because he had some really serious health concerns. He wasn't able to play. Comes back, kind of slowly works his way back. Two more Stanley Cups. Everything's great. And then actually, I guess the second cup year and then the year after was about as good as we'd ever seen him. Same as ever. You know, I think there was a lot of people making the case. He probably deserved another Hart Trophy somewhere in there. Last year, the year before, maybe a little bit more ups and downs. Pittsburgh's had some of their own questions with depth, who plays with Sidney Crosby, all of that kind of stuff. But here we are. He's not Sid the Kid anymore. But no. he's still got an incredible ability, and we saw in the first couple games that Pittsburgh's played that he's not going away. I don't know yet about Pittsburgh and where I stand with them as a team, especially within the division that they're playing in. But Sidney Crosby is not going quietly into that night, and it showed pretty much from the start. And then look, I mean, I've done this whole career retrospective here about Sidney Crosby. We probably don't even have to go much further than the fact that they lost in the qualifying round last year. And that's going to be a swift kick for a team like Pittsburgh, a team that's got a very aggressive general manager in Jim Rutherford. They made some moves. They made some of them I think people really like. Some of them I think people had questions about, but ultimately the leader is going to be Sidney Crosby. And through the first bit, he looked good. It's going to be weird not seeing him up against Canadian teams, but I'll certainly keep an eye on Pittsburgh this year and him not sounding any alarm bells about retirement anytime soon. But I do kind of get into that place sometimes with athletes, especially the ones that are as great as Sidney Crosby, of wanting to fully appreciate them while they're still at the peak of their powers. And I'm seeing a little bit of that in the NFL right now too, with Tom Brady, Drew Brees. We don't know if these are among their final games. Aaron Rodgers and the Packers earned a bye, and they're playing this weekend as well, playing on Saturday as the number one seed in the NFC. Not sounding any alarm bells on Aaron Rodgers possibly retiring either, but he's 37. So at some point it's going to end. And for a player like Sidney Crosby, to me, it's important to catalog, you know, what he's done over the last 15, 20 years of his career.
For sure. Well, and you know what, I look when the Pens start 0-2 against sort of their division and state rivals in Philly, it definitely raises a few eyebrows. Crosby's got 5 years left on his deal, but I, as you said, I don't think Crosby's the problem.
Yeah.
It's, you know, they've got two more years of Malkin and two more years of Letang. And Letang has played a lot of heavy hockey and his body's taken a bit of a toll. But the biggest thing I look at is I don't think there's going to be a quick rebuild. The Pens do not have a first round pick, third round pick, fourth round pick, or sixth round pick this coming draft because they have tried to keep this core going. And, you know, to your point, I think they might be starting to run out of road, whether it's this year or next year. They'll have those two big salaries coming off the books, but that's 2 years away.
Yeah.
And Crosby, you know, much like Jonathan Toews, and we talked about this last week with Chicago, those guys, you know, they have accomplished what they need to accomplish in their careers. Yes, they love the game, but they want to win. And clearly Chicago is not at a place where they can win right now. It'll be interesting to see what happens here with the Penguins going forward. Quickly, you touched on the NFL. We got four games. The first one kind of kicking off in just over an hour here. The matchup you're most excited for this weekend as we kind of get into the divisional playoffs of the National Football League.
I mean, like I said, the slam dunk is Bucks Saints, two all-time quarterbacks. They've matched up in some pretty good games so far this season since they're already in the same division. So that one's good. But I am really interested from just kind of a, maybe more of a football nerd perspective in Baltimore and Buffalo with their quarterbacks. We saw Josh Allen play quite well in his first playoff game. And he's been, you know, he had a really strong start to the season and maybe some questions in the middle of the year. And then he finished really strong again. And then Lamar Jackson, it feels like his MVP was ages ago, but it was just last full season and made some monster plays to get Baltimore past Tennessee. So I look at that game tonight on Saturday night and really fascinated by the quarterback matchup, the way that it looked, you know, the future of that position, these huge, big, strong guys that can throw and can run. And the flip side of that is, how do these teams game plan against that, especially for these two teams that have the similar type quarterback, so that they know what it's like to go up against them in practice. And this is when the coaching comes into play. And look, we saw how important coaching was last week in the Seahawks game against the Rams. The Seahawks got thoroughly outcoached. And look, yes, there were some questions about Russell Wilson's play, but ultimately you pull back. It was a great game plan by the Rams defense. The Seahawks were not prepared. Anytime that there's that bad of an interception, like the one Russell Wilson threw for a pick six, where a receiver screen is getting blown up by a defensive back because he knows the play is coming, that says everything you need to know. So yeah, from a nerd standpoint, I'm pretty fired up for Bills and Ravens. What about you?
Yeah, no, actually, to be honest, I think to your point, the big marquee matchup is going to be the Sunday. I mean, it's not even a night game. It starts at 3:40, but the Bucks and the Saints. We'll actually have a chance to get a little bit deeper into this with Richard Deitch, because I know he went to university in Buffalo, so he follows the Bills fairly closely. And as a media columnist with The Athletic, he will be all over Bucks Saints just from like a media perspective. And with Sat joining us at 1 o'clock, I'm not sure I know a bigger Browns fan, so we'll be able to sort of unpack the Browns and Chiefs and whether Cleveland has a chance in that matchup. Quickly, we've got a few minutes here. There was a huge trade in the NBA this week after sort of, you know, a couple of weeks of sort of tabloids and rumors and a little bit of distraction coming out of Houston. The Rockets finally deal James Harden. He goes to Brooklyn in what was a massive sort of four-team blockbuster trade.
Yeah, a lot of players, a lot of picks.
Yeah, and I'm just curious what you thought. Do you like Harden in Brooklyn? What did you make of the overall deal and the teams that it impacts?
We just talked about the Pittsburgh Penguins and how they've sort of reached the end of their rope, but this has been a long one with Sidney Crosby and Malkin and Letang having been in the fold for a long time. The NBA moves quickly, and so Kevin Durant's only played a handful of games for this team. Kyrie Irving, even going back to last year, has only played a handful of games for this team. But this is the way that the NBA works. You got to go all in. James Harden is a player that statistically is almost unprecedented, and there are probably some justified concerns about some playoff performance stuff and some possible, you know, teammate stuff. Those questions are valid. I'm not going to ignore those. I think that they stand next to the statistical unprecedentedness of his career, not necessarily overshadowing them. But this is what the Nets felt like they had to do. I think that this is where teams are in the NBA. You go all in. Kevin Durant, in the few games that he has played for Brooklyn this year, has looked great. He's looked as good as he's looked in a long time. And Harden, while a bit of an unorthodox player, can fit in with a player like Kevin Durant, because Harden is a ball handler, but he's also a better playmaker than people give him credit for. You look at his assist numbers. He's a very good passer. It's just he, for whatever reason, gets that ball hog tag a little bit. But yeah, I mean, crazy trade. The way that the whole Houston situation has imploded since Daryl Morey left there as the GM, going back in the summer and ultimately ending up in Philadelphia, which by all accounts was the team that finished second for Harden. They were also pushing hard to get him. Yeah, I think Alex's life in the NBA, you get star players, you try to make it work. Especially with a team like Brooklyn that's got some of that more market-specific stuff. Like, the Knicks are still the big team in New York. They're the establishment. Brooklyn has tried multiple times now. Obviously, they made the big trade with the Celtics a number of years ago to get Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett and go down that road for a championship. This is a better bet.
This feels even bigger to me than that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what I wonder is, I think they're going to score. I just wonder if they're going to be able to defend. And, you know, I was chatting to Marcus Fitzgerald this morning, and he said they'll score 125 a night, but they also might give up 130. And he has questions whether that'll, sustain itself in the playoffs. Should mention that, you know, Houston gives up Harden, but they get back. I think they got three players, but they got four first round picks and also four first round pick swaps. So the ability to swap first round picks if they would like to.
Yeah.
Quickly, the Blue Jays had some news this week, news and sort of unnews. Suspicious that they dropped the Mark Shapiro extension on day one of the NHL. Like, they know what they're doing. I sort of thought, you know, why would you want to bury that news? I guess the other news of the week is that DJ LeMahieu re-signed with the Yankees. He was clearly a target that the Jays were looking for. The Jays reportedly offered him 4 years at $78 million. He took more years, but less annual average value with the Yankees. But it was, you know, as long as the Yankees were in it, I think he was going to go back to New York.
Yeah, I agree. That was one of the five or six players that they'd been linked with that I didn't think was going to happen. It was not a great positional fit. He's a good player. He's been a good player for the Yankees. He was a good player going back to Colorado. But this is, you mentioned the Shapiro extension. Anytime that a CEO is announced, normally companies and organizations make a really big deal about that or extend it, right? That's not even just the sports thing. That's like a stock price thing.
For sure.
Where you make pomp and circumstance and you fire up the board and you do all of this kind of stuff. And it was a bit peculiar the way that it was handled. And it comes in the middle of an offseason where the Blue Jays made some big promises to the fan base about being aggressive, going out and adding to this team that surprised people and was exciting. I think they were inconsistent last year, but they were ultimately a playoff team, and they surprised some people, they excited some people, and they haven't been able to make anything happen so far this year. So it's going to be really, really fascinating to see how the rest of the offseason plays out with the Shapiro extension, and can they get George Springer, can they get Trevor Bauer, so on and so forth.
Yeah, and reportedly they have an offer out to center fielder George Springer, 5 years at $115 million. It sounds like he is hoping that there might be some other teams in the mix, but with the Mets signing Francisco Lindor, there's a belief that they may have sort of priced themselves out of that. Quickly, we're going to have Richard Deitch on next. What are you excited to chat about, Richard about?
Yeah, Rich is an authority on sports media, sports broadcasting. I think it's going to be another challenge here. We've seen it, some of the changes that broadcasters have had to adapt to. In the summer, it was the playoff bubble, some of the things there. Now there's some remote broadcasts. There's limited travel. There's going to be some of that stuff, just kind of basic stuff with the NHL. We've seen a little bit with the NBA as well. And then I also want to ask him about the Nickelodeon game that we saw in the NFL last week, which was a lot of fun. And Richard had some coverage of that at The Athletic. So coming up next, we'll talk to Richard Deitch of The Athletic, of Sportsnet 590, The Fan. And we'll do that next. You're on air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair.
It's time for Sportsnet Today. This is On Air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
On Air rolls on. Israel Fair, Alex Blair live on Sportsnet 650. Every Saturday it is Canucks game day, Canucks and Flames, 7 p.m. Coverage throughout the day right here on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Coming up right now, we'll talk to Richard Deitch of The Athletic and Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Before we get to Richard, who is a big tennis fan, so he may have a take or an observation about the news today out of the Australian Open. Alex, what can you tell the audience?
Yeah, some big COVID-related news coming out of Melbourne. And it actually has ties to Canadian Bianca Andreescu. Her coach, Sylvain Bruneau, was one of a couple of people that tested positive for COVID upon landing in Melbourne. And I guess the way the ATP had set this up is they had a couple of charter flights bringing all of the players and support staff. One was coming from Los Angeles. One was coming from Abu Dhabi. They were tested prior to getting on the plane at those locations. Everyone tested negative. But upon arriving in Melbourne, a flight attendant tested positive and Dreskiu's coach tested positive. The big impact here is that now 47 of the players that were on those flights have to self-isolate in their hotel rooms for 14 days. No practicing, no leaving the hotel rooms. And this is on the eve of the Australian Open, which is, you know, the first, the first Grand Slam of the year, if you will. So yep. Some big news coming out of Australia in regards to COVID and tennis.
Yeah, I guess it's just we've, as a collective sports society, have agreed to start having games within a pandemic, and this is the way it's going to be. So I don't think there's going to be much grousing of a competitive imbalance and stuff being unfair. I think it's very much just the way it is right now. I mean, we've seen it with the NBA, a number of postponements. We'll see what happens with the NHL. Both of us, and maybe even more than you last week, felt pretty confident that the Canadian division wouldn't have serious COVID problems. And then immediately the Canucks had their practice canceled, within a couple of days after we had that announcement. Right. So anyway, something to track coming out of the Australian Open. We'll get Richard Deitch's thoughts on it, because I know he's a big tennis fan, but we're joining him. He's joining us now on air. It's Richard Deitch from The Athletic. Longtime media columnist, prior to that Sports Illustrated. Also, you can hear him on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. First of all, Richard, thanks for taking the time. We want to start with some of the challenges that come with TV broadcasting, to a lesser extent, radio broadcasting, sports in a pandemic. I know that you've done a number of stories at The Athletic, talking to broadcasters, talking to executives at organizations. Canucks fans noticed the other night that the local broadcast for the Canucks, they were doing a remote broadcast from Vancouver for the game in Edmonton, and the sound wasn't exactly synced up with the action, which wasn't a huge impediment by any means, but was something that people noticed. What can you tell the audience about some of the challenges that, whether it's a production team or the broadcaster themselves, or, you know, the organizations overall, are going through right now as they try to pull off regular professional broadcasts of sporting events?
Well, first, good to be with you guys. The short answer is everything's a challenge. Nothing is normal in this unprecedented environment. The networks that have been able to normalize things as best as possible have had a lot of reps at doing it. So your ESPNs or your, you know, Sportsnets or TSNs or NBCs, they've now been working in a pandemic for a little under a year. They've had a lot of broadcasts, so they've been able to do a lot of troubleshooting. They understand how to make the latency work. And for your audience who doesn't know, latency is to sync up everything. So it literally sounds as if they're in an arena or a stadium, as opposed to a 1 or a half second delay or a half second delay between the play-by-play person and the color analyst who may be in two different places. The challenges are just immense. I mean, the challenge is a technological challenge, because a lot of times you will have the production team, the director, the producer, the editor, et cetera, at one location, usually some kind of sports headquarters. And then you may have a play-by-play person at one location, his or her house, or a studio near his or her house, and an analyst at one location, his or her house, or a studio. You know, you try your best to have both studio analysts, not studio analysts, I'm sorry. You try your best to have both play-by-play person and color analysts next to each other, and that can be done, but then you need to have a studio where they can socially distance and that where you're following COVID protocols. So by and large, the networks have an advantage because they have more money and they have more production capabilities. And then when it gets a little bit smaller, like regional productions, they don't have as much production availability. They don't have as much as many resources, and they probably haven't done this as much as possible. And so that's where you may sometimes get into broadcast issues. But it's just tough for everybody. I mean, these are unprecedented times. The fact that we're actually still getting these games on air is a good thing. But I think if you're a viewer or a listener, you have to just sort of have a little bit of leeway that things are not going to be what you normally are used to.
The Athletics media reporter Richard Deitch joining us on air. Richard, one of the other trends we had seen through the first few months of the pandemic was that television ratings for sporting events had been down almost universally across the board. That seemed to change. We got some good news both north and south of the border on Wednesday. Sportsnet reported incredibly high ratings for the first night of the NHL. And I know NBC, Sports Network down in the States, they reported the highest per regular season game record for the Penguins Flyers game. Just curious to ask you, is this a trend you think will continue, or was this sort of an anomaly, just, you know, the first game back out of the gate and people were curious to see what it was going to look like?
Yeah, that's hard to know. I mean, if I had to guess, I would guess it was an anomaly more than a mass of people have decided to discover the NHL. I do think the NHL actually has some interesting things this year, viewership-wise, that will help them. The Canadian division, first and foremost, I think is really going to be rocket fuel for Rogers in Canada. I'm not just saying that, obviously, because I work for Rogers. I think there's just going to, whenever there's a novelty at play, a lot of times you can get short-term viewership pops, and that's one I would expect for the Canadian division. You know, while it's interesting, I think, let's say, for the Maple Leafs to play the Bruins and Maple Leafs to play the Rangers, ultimately, I think more Canadians are going to be interested if, you know, if Ottawa's playing Montreal or Vancouver's playing Calgary and Edmonton's playing Calgary. I mean, it's not really some genius take by me. It's just sort of just think about it. In the same way, the Rangers and Islanders will always have interest more than the Rangers playing the Kings or something like that. So I think you got a chance to get some better viewership numbers this year overall. I do think, though, opening night was more about hockey fans have been waiting for this for a long time. And at least in the States, you had the Penguins and the Flyers, which is a pretty good matchup in terms of some diehard fan bases in Pennsylvania. So I think they over-indexed on the East Coast in terms of viewers. And so I would not expect the NHL to beat every trend that has existed out there. And generally speaking, every single sport is down, and a lot of the jewel events are down massive double digits. You know, whether that's the Stanley Cup Final, the NBA Finals, the Kentucky Derby, the final round of the Masters. I mean, these are all down, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60% from the year before. It would seemingly be inconceivable to me for the NHL to reverse that trend. The NHL is playing now post-U.S. election, so, you know, you may have some people migrate away from cable and look at sports, although, you know, with the state of the United States political system at the moment, I put a big caveat on that. Who knows what's going to happen, unfortunately, in the next 10 days, and I say that as an American with concern. But I don't see it. I mean, the NHL would essentially have to break every single trend that has existed since March 17th in order to get an increase, and I don't see it. So I see opening night a little bit more as an anomaly and a little bit more of the games that sort of were out there. I think people were just really excited to see.
Richard, when the news came out this week that the Toronto Maple Leafs had signed a deal with Amazon Entertainment to sort of take part in their next All or Nothing, you were somebody that I wanted to talk to about this. It's the first time that Amazon has partnered with an NHL club for this project. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to the significance of this for not only the Maple Leafs, but the NHL. And I guess inevitably growing the game outside of, you know, Canada and outside of sort of the core hockey audience, how big an impact could this project have on that?
I mean, it helps. I would say I would be measured in terms of placing some kind of like large scale significance on, you know, a 24/7 HBO Hard Knocks-ish project. We we've had a lot of these before. You know, the all access behind the scenes of a team is not a new concept by any means, and we've seen it. But it's Amazon. They're obviously going to put a ton of money towards it. You're going to get some really good distribution when it comes out. And so, you know, it can only help. Obviously, if the Maple Leafs have a good year, it helps more because, you know, then you have a team that draws interest because of the success of the team. So all of these kind of projects help sell the league and specifically help sell the team that's involved in the project. But very, very rarely can a project like this, I think, make a significant impact in terms of bigger viewership trends. What I would say, you know, would help more in terms of growing the game, particularly in the States, would be for NBC to have more Canadian teams on its schedule. But here lies the rub. If NBC broadcasts, let's say, Toronto and Edmonton, they're not going to get a good viewership because they don't get those markets. And so the viewership for that game in the States will essentially just be the American markets that watched it. So it's a short-term loss, but I would argue a long-term gain because you're exposing the American audience to the best players in the league. NBC has opted, generally speaking, not to do that for the most part. They stick with big markets like Philly or Chicago or the Rangers, and, you know, because they need to sell to advertisers, et cetera. That's usually been their strategy. So to me, something like that, showing more Canadian teams, I feel like would be better to grow the game, particularly in the States, than having like an all-access behind-the-scenes project the way the Amazon project is. Regardless, though, it'll certainly be, I'm sure it'll be very high quality, high level, professionally done. And for Maple Leafs fans, I think they'll really enjoy it for sure.
I asked you about the challenges for broadcasters and for broadcasts in general during a pandemic. A bit of a more positive story, I guess, is the Nickelodeon broadcast in the NFL of a playoff game last week. On Twitter during the game, it was all the rage. It seemed like the reaction was extremely positive. This was more so with adults than with kids that would, I think were the target audience in general. But what did you make of the reaction to the Nickelodeon broadcast? Is this something that we could see, maybe not necessarily Nickelodeon, but other sports organizations, other TV broadcasters taking more chances with their broadcasts from a visual perspective? Seems like we lost Richard there. Some good insight. Hopefully we can get him back here. We will connect with our producer who is working remotely and see if we can get Richard Deitch back in the meantime. What did you make of what Richard shared with us? I thought there was a lot of interesting stuff there, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because over Christmas I read, I think it was Scott Burnside had done a piece looking back on the 10-year anniversary of the first 24/7, the Penguins Capitals one. And I know, you know, that was something that gave a different lens into the game. And if you weren't necessarily maybe a core hockey fan, there was a level of storytelling, there was a level of insight that may have connected you as an outside viewer. I know during the pandemic, you know, the F1 Drive to Survive is a series that I've gotten into. Was not necessarily a huge F1 fan, but it's something that I'm now connected to through that production. So, Richard, I don't know how much of Izzy's question you heard there regarding the Nickelodeon broadcast, but we were just asking you your thoughts and if it's something that we may see more of from last week's NFL broadcast.
Yeah, for sure. Get ready to be slimed once again. There's no doubt that the NFL will do it. I mean, unquestionably, it's a massive success. 2 million people watching on Nickelodeon. That's, you know, 2 million potential NFL viewers that will watch ahead of time. I don't think, you know, 2 million of those viewers were all like 7-year-old kids, but there were certainly some families.
Right.
For sure. So if you're the NFL, you know, you just landed into a demo that you normally cannot hit with your normal broadcast. So. That alone, I think the viewership number alone would have them do it again. The critical success part is just the rocket fuel for CBS and NFL to absolutely do it again, because it was a, you know, it was a critical success. They got so much good promotion out of it, particularly on social media. And I think other sports, which means other networks and leagues, are going to try to duplicate it and do the same thing. So I would honestly be very surprised if in the next 12 months you don't see Disney slash ESPN ABC try to figure out a way to Star Wars up a you know, an MLB game or an NBA game. I could see the NHL doing it either via and whatever NBC's children's property is, Comcast property, or whatever Rogers has. I should know that as a Rogers employee. I don't. But you basically, the idea is really easily duplicative. I can't tell you, I haven't written about this a lot. It took them months to sort of plan and to do. This is not something you just wake up one day and decide to do. But all of these places have enough assets where, given enough time, given enough planning, they can pull this off. So yeah, you will absolutely see another Nickelodeon NFL broadcast. I can't tell you when yet, but it'll happen. And I would bet pretty big that you're going to see this duplicated in other sports too.
The Athletic's Richard Deitch joining us here on air. Sticking with the NFL, Richard, as someone who went to university in Buffalo, how much has this Bills season and this playoff run meant to Buffalo? And do you think they can keep it going against the Ravens?
Yes. Thank you for reminding me. I went to the University of Buffalo in 1921. I'm a graduate. It was a very exciting year. It's been, you listen, you know, I'm, you know, I think all of us, you guys can empathize with this with me. We don't really root anymore. At a certain point when you've worked long enough in sports media, I mean, there are still people, you know, it's sort of, I should take that back. There are obviously our media people who sort of root. I root more for cities or for stories than I do for individual teams, but I certainly have fondness for Buffalo. I want that city to do well. I know how important the Bills are to the city, and they had such a long and miserable and dark run in that city when it came to the Bills, either not having success or the sort of small success they had usually ended in you know, historically horrible ways. So this is a great run. They have a really, really good young team, a quarterback who seems to be becoming a star every minute, great skill position players. The only sort of downside in this is I wish that Bill Stadium had 80,000 people tonight, because I think that would be such a great reward for that community. I also think it would make it hard as hell on the Ravens. It's a very, you know, there are some home field advantages in the NFL. Buffalo, Kansas City, Seattle, you know, they're really home field advantages. Like, they make a significant difference. And I think today that crowd would be a factor in the game, you know, like a field goal factor for sure. So I wish they could get that experience, but it's been phenomenal to watch. You know, I live in Toronto now, so I'm not so far away from Buffalo. I would really love to see them in the title game. Most likely will be against the Chiefs. I think that would be a great title game. It would be such a reward for those fans who've been waiting for this forever. And I would say that team, you know, depending on health and maybe depending on how they draft, like this year coming up, they got a real chance to be a Super Bowl team in the next 3 years, as long as Josh Allen stays healthy. And man, that's an exciting prospect for Buffalo. There are many people who still live with Scott Norwood's miss against the Giants, and I would love to see that city win a Super Bowl. I mean, it's a little cliche to say. I'm sure Vancouver feels the same way. Like, you know, certain cities deserve a championship because of how close they've been. But having lived there, like, that city was so close to having a sports championship, and, you know, like 3 inches to the right. And so I would love to see them in the next couple of years win a title.
I've been to a couple games in Orchard Park. I can confirm that it is quite the experience. Whenever this world gets back to normal and we can travel, I recommend to anybody to spend an afternoon there, because from the tailgate to the environment in the stadium, it's awesome. Richard, we'll get you out of here on this. Some news from Australia ahead of the Australian Open. 47 players have to quarantine. I know you're a big tennis guy. What did you make of the news today?
Yeah, I saw the Bianca news. It's a bummer that What happened with their coach? I mean, listen, I thought you guys set it up very well. This is inevitable. If you're going to attempt to play global sports in the pandemic, you're going to have COVID positives. That's just the reality of the world we live in. You know, you hope your protocols are such that when that happens, people will follow and listen and quarantine and then ultimately become healthy so they can't spread the virus. But, like, it's inevitable. Every single sport, every global sport has had this. And so, you know, we will wait and see if the Australian Open and then later on in the year, obviously Wimbledon, et cetera, like if they have enough players to pull it off. You know, it's a really, I think, a very tricky choice for some of these great players like Bianca or Federer, you know, Djokovic, Nadal, et cetera, as to sort of where you decide to travel and what is the risk reward. You know, obviously the reward, of course, is to get a chance at winning a major and playing again. The risk is obviously such that you're traveling in the middle of a pandemic. So tennis, like the Olympics, you know, like Formula One, like soccer, these are interesting sports for me to watch when it comes to sort of a COVID universe, because it's literally the opposite of a bubble. And all these athletes, even with the wealth that they have, they're all taking risks the second they hit that plane. And so while I was bummed to see it, I'm certainly not surprised. I think literally every tennis tournament that exists in 2021 is most likely going to have some kind of COVID positives.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough part of it, but I hopefully the pros outweigh the cons, and the tournament is able to go off a little bit later this month, and some good tennis can be played. Anyway, Richard, appreciate the time, appreciate the insight, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Appreciate the invite, guys. Thank you.
All right, Richard Deitch, you can find his work at The Athletic. You can also hear him on Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590, The Fan in Toronto. Encourage you to check out his work at The Athletic. Always a really good insight into what's going on in sports broadcasting, what's going on in sports media. Some recent stories, the Nickelodeon broadcast, also look into the HBO Tiger Woods documentary that I assume Alex might want to talk about later in the show, and so on and so forth. But coming up next, we'll talk some Canucks. Satshaw from the program right here on Sportsnet 650 will join us next. This is On Air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair on the official home for the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
It's time for Sportsnet Today. This is On Air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
It is On Air, Israel Fair, Alex Blair, live on Sportsnet 650 every Saturday. We'll dive into some Canucks talk with Sat Shaw on an all-day Canucks affair right here, Sportsnet 650, Canucks Game Day, Flames, and Vancouver puck drop. Just after 7 o'clock, plenty more coming up on the station after us. We do have a couple of texts here, Alex, from the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. Let's start with this one from Torgy and Langley. If I had a first pick for my team to win a seven-game series, it's Sid, not even a question. And now I'll ask you the question that Torgy asks us. Do you think Sid finishes his career in Pittsburgh?
I do, but I think that it will not be seamless. I think inevitably Sid will stay there. I think that'll be part of his legacy. Very rarely have we seen a player of his ilk in any sport change teams and for it to end iconically. You know, I mean, even Peyton Manning, who ended up in Denver, you know, he goes out as a Super Bowl champion, but, you know, I think in a lot of ways people look at that and they thought, you know, good for Peyton. He'd given a lot to the game, but that defense and the rest of that Broncos team were really what sort of took that team to the championship.
Yep.
You know, I do think there will be, I mean, 5 years is a long time. And as we talked about, the Penguins are, you know, GM Jim Rutherford will have his hands full trying to stick handle the cap as it remains flat here for the next couple of years, as that group gets aging and without a number of draft picks. But Sid to me seems like a very loyal, consistent, managed guy. And I think he would retire early before switching teams on the Penguins.
Yeah, I can't see him playing anywhere else. This is not equivalent to, say, someone like Joe Thornton, who just left San Jose to go to Toronto late in his career. I mean, Joe Thornton made a move in the prime of his career that was much discussed at the time. Sidney Crosby's, we mentioned, he's got the legacy, he's got the trophies there. It's really hard to imagine that he would move out. He would move on strictly to win. He's won, as you said earlier today.
And worth noting that two of the players that Sidney sort of idolized the most growing up were Steve Yzerman and Joe Sakic.
Right.
And those are two players who remained with their organizations. They are iconically linked to both of those organizations. They could have, you know, changed teams. They had to take lesser roles later in their career.
Sure.
But I think that's telling as well, the type of players that Sid looked up to, not from a skill standpoint, but also how they carried themselves and how they carried their careers.
Another text here. This is Canucks specific. It'll help set up our conversation with Sportsnet 650 Satyar Shah. This text is from Gary in Mission. I thought the Canucks fourth line looked really good. They were, in my mind, very noticeable and actually had some scoring opportunities. Therefore, I think we're not talking about them enough. That's obviously going to be a big question this season, Alex. The fourth line, the depth. The Canucks have some questions about their third line. They certainly have gotten a lot of criticism about their fourth line. I think Tyler Motte impressed some people with the playoffs that he had, with the exception of that one game against St. Louis where he was out there for a bunch of goals against and out there a lot. They have a role to play, but what do you make of what we've seen through the first couple of games, or what's the upside of that lineup for Vancouver?
Well, I think they have the potential to have an impact. I mean, I'd like to see a little bit heavier, harder hockey from them. You know, like, they can make it difficult on the opposing team's defensemen and even the forwards to that degree. You know, like, when they're out there, be neutral offensively, but wear the other team down and don't give up things offensively. I thought Brandon Sutter looked all right. To your point, Tyler Motte looked good. Again, the one to me, and I know, you know, there's been more ink spilled on him in Vancouver than, you know, you could probably tally, but Jake Virtanen, I'm still not sure what he is. I'm not sure he knows what he is yet. And, you know, that's more of a third line impact role, but, you know, I thought the fourth line was all right. I think they need to keep it going. And I think they could increase their, sort of their physical impact on the game, if you will, making it harder for the other team to play.
All right, he's on the line now. It's Sat Shah, a friend of the show. You hear him all the time right here on Sportsnet 650. Happy to have him on. Thankful that he's decided to take a little of time to talk to us about the Canucks today. So first of all, Sat, thanks for doing this. Let's just start with tonight's game. We'll have plenty of time to dig into what we've seen and what we might see. But what are your expectations for the Canucks tonight, facing off against the Flames for the first of 10 games against Calgary this year?
Well, I'm expecting them to have a bit of a bounce back performance, right? Like, that's really what they need here. And that's going to be the story of this season, where you play back-to-back games against the same team in the same barn. You win the first game, well, chances are the team wins the next one. And you're going to have to find a way to bounce back emotional wins, emotional losses in a big, big way. And as much as the Calgary Flames might have lots of money on the board tonight with Markstrom, you know, Chris Tanev and Josh Lebo on the team and getting those guys motivated to face the Canucks, I do think we're going to see Vancouver have a good showing. I am expecting them to look a lot more like the team we saw in the first game of the season, as opposed to what we saw the other night in Edmonton, where the Oilers were clearly the better team than the Canucks.
Sat, we talked off the top that the power play on paper hasn't performed, but Izzy and I surmised that we thought they actually, you know, they looked quite good. There was a lot of possession, a lot of movement in the offensive zone. Just your takeaway on the power play through the first two games.
Yeah, I'm with you, Alex. I thought they moved the puck really well in the second game. They had some opportunities where they didn't score, and it reminded me a bit of, we saw the first game Connor McDavid played, and it was like people wanted to dunk on him for not getting any goals, and they're like, hey, Connor McDavid, this and that, or whatever, whatever, and then the guy lights up the next game with three goals. But if you go back and watch the first game, Connor McDavid could have had two or three goals in the first game as well. There was a few great saves from Brayden Holtby. He hit the bar, and the puck rolled over the crossbar just as time was about to expire at the end of the game as well. So we're talking about a guy who was really, really close. The Canucks power play does seem like it's a PP that is pretty, pretty close. They probably need something to go their way, and all of a sudden they'll probably get a few going. But I like the puck movement on it. not having JT Miller is a bit of an issue. The thing they miss the most about not having JT, he's so good at being assertive when he's on the ice and going into other players' space and forcing movement, but he also knows how to put a guy on his hip and then turn towards and draw a defender to him, and then he dishes off to open space. Having that guy that can really drive while you're set up in the power play was able to create open lanes for Pettersson to get a shot, or Besser to get a shot, or Bo Horvat to get a net front goal, or even Quinn Hughes getting an open lane from the top. We haven't seen quite those things developing, and I think a big part of it is not having JT Miller. But I'm with you, Alex. I do think the power play has looked better than what the results have shown, and I wouldn't be surprised if this is the night to have a bit of a breakthrough.
You mentioned JT Miller there. As best we could determine, they are still trying to figure out exactly when JT Miller could return. What I was told this morning is best case is Wednesday against Montreal, so that would have him missing the next two games. Worst case would be the full 14 days, which has him not returning until Monday the 25th against Ottawa. That would be missing another five games. Is that your understanding, or do you have a different interpretation of what you've heard?
I mentioned this the other night, and so there has been some positive developments, and I don't mean that as in a positive test, so I got to be careful using the word positive when we're talking about COVID, but as far as I can gather, he has not tested positive. And when you look at the number of tests he needs to get for them to have a pretty good idea that he's going to be clear, they're pretty close to that if that hasn't been reached yet. The big thing here is getting approval from health authorities and also the National Hockey League to allow this to happen. I don't want to get too much into the game, but I'm predicting this. As you know, with COVID, it's one of those fluid situations. We're trying to keep people informed the best we can about all the possibilities. As of today, I still feel pretty good about him being back in the lineup on Wednesday. And had the Canucks been at home, well, there could have been a chance. Perhaps even he plays on the Monday. But with the travel situation, the restrictions, he has to quarantine, that's just completely out of the equation. But I wouldn't be surprised that we do see JT Miller back on Wednesday, especially if he keeps, you know, testing negative like he has so far. It's also really tricky with what happened with Jordy Benn, and I don't think we have the full picture yet because he's had a few tests flip-flop. And does that mean he actually has COVID? Does that mean he has some of the virus in his body, but he's not infectious because the viral load wasn't high enough? These are things we don't have answers to. So with Jordy Benn, if he indeed has COVID and is infectious, well, then the health authorities might look at this and say, hey, we don't want to give, you know, the NHL, or give the perception that we're giving the NHL a free pass on this by not forcing him to miss 14 days. But when you're testing every day, and based on everything we've seen so far, logic would dictate, as long as things go okay, that JT Miller should be back on Wednesday against the Habs. I know some people in the organization have felt encouraged about what's happened the past few days. So hopefully that maintains, and we do see JT against the Habs on Wednesday.
Satyar Shah joins us on air. You'll hear Sat later on Sportsnet 650 hosting the Canucks pregame show, and also during the week, every day, Monday to Friday, 4 to 7 on the program with Andrew Walker and Bick Nazar. Sat, when it comes to the Canucks, the first couple of games, normally I think we would have expected some chatter about the goaltending, but the performance of Holtby in game one, Demko in game two, despite it playing in a loss, I think people were pretty encouraged. What did you think of the goaltending, and how do you imagine at least the short-term split looks like for those two?
So Holtby was really good in game one. I know the numbers don't show that he was incredible because the goals against were three, the save percentage was like 903 or whatever it is, but he was really good in the first game. Demko wasn't bad. He made a number of good saves, but he wasn't as in control as you saw, you know, Holtby be in the first game, right? Like with his play in the crease and how steady he was and how compact he played that entire game. And Demko was good. He wasn't a problem or anything. But at the same time, you're trying to win as many games as quickly as you can right now. And if Braden Holtby has a really strong game tonight, I wouldn't be surprised, Izzy, that we see Travis give Holtby a few games here, because you do have a few days in between, right? I mean, the Canucks play tonight, they play the Flames again on Monday, and then they come back and play the Habs on Wednesday. So if Holtby has a really good game tonight, I could see them kind of just give him a few starts here and try to ride the hot hand. I know you want to have as even a split as possible. Part of navigating this year, too, is if a guy gets going, you got to lean on that guy a bit, especially in spaces where you don't have back-to-back games. So I wouldn't be surprised, Izzy, that if we see Holtby have a strong game today, he gets a few in a row here.
The Flames are off. They lost to the Winnipeg Jets the other night. What do you make of this Calgary team, which Brad Treliving has done, some significant surgery to over the offseason, Sat?
Man, boom or bust. It's the most boom or bust team in the Canadian division this year, in the North Division, I should say, because there's a pathway that this team wins the division, right? I mean, look at the goaltending, look at the defense, look at the firepower they have up front. If things click and fall into place, especially with the perceived depth they might have, man, this is a team that could have everything going for them. The issue with the Calgary Flames, however, is the mix right? Regardless of what it looks like on paper, you look at the defense, you're like, well, it makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, you have a puck-moving guy, you have a stay-at-home defenseman, all these guys move really well. Depth-wise, it looks like a very strong top six on paper. Look at the goaltending duo. Well, Jacob Markstrom, one of the best goalies in the league last year. Dave Riddick maybe struggles as a starting goalie, but if he all of a sudden becomes your backup and he's playing 15 games out of 56 or 18 games, that's a pretty good backup. So in theory, that looks pretty good. The big issue I have with the Flames is, what are you getting with their top-end guys? Is Johnny Gaudreau back? Is Sean Monahan back? Are you going to see this team play with conviction? Are you going to see this team be able to maintain its confidence? Because they do wane really fast. I mean, it's a very Jekyll and Hyde team. So I do, in theory, like the aggressiveness that Brad Treliving had this offseason, going out and getting all these guys. But if I had to choose what would happen, I might lean on the bust side, because there's a lot of volatility with this roster at the same time. And a big part of it, too, is the two new guys they added. Chris Tanev, when he's healthy early in the season, he's going to be fantastic. How long can you lean on him? Is he going to be able to stay healthy all year? And what happens if he falls off? And Jacob Markstrom is an incredibly talented goaltender. But he's also been a goalie that, if he gets out of his comfort zone, it can get a little bit dicey at times. There is some inconsistency to his game. The past 18 months, if you go back to not this past season, but the season before, it was around Christmas where he figured it out. He started becoming a really good goaltender. And last season, he was good all year long, right? So we're essentially looking at 18 months or a season and a half of elite goalie play from Jacob Markstrom. That also coincided with working very hard with Ian Clarke and really his game fitting how the Canucks were playing. It doesn't mean he can't be great in Calgary, but it means that there is a chance here that it's going to be a bit of an uncomfortable start. And it might take a while for the system to adjust to him to adjust to the system, and to work with the goalie coach. And how is he going to handle some ups and downs in the season? Jacob Markstrom is super motivated. He also can get his back up really quickly, too, at the same time. How is he going to handle the emotional ups and downs of being on a new team and figuring out his game? So I do have some concern about the Calgary Flames. And if I'm trying to project that team, I'm leaning on the bust side more than the boom, but it is the team in the division that has the highest ceiling and the lowest floor compared to the other teams.
A big offseason addition for Vancouver was Nate Schmidt through a couple of games. We saw, I think, a lot of good things from him, but maybe not the massive impact that people had been predicting. Obviously, it's two games. It doesn't mean much, but what did you see from Schmidt in his first couple of games for the Canucks?
I like a lot of what I'm seeing from Nate Schmidt. I mean, yeah, there's going to be some mistakes here and there, right? You saw the blown coverage at the time. It will happen with a guy who's going to be aggressive, jumps into the play and looks to make plays with the puck. But it's just such a boost having a guy like him on the back end, because he's not quite like Quinn in terms of being a one-man breakout, but he gets the puck on his stick. It's getting out of his own end, whether he's skating out or making a good pass. And numerous times in that first game particularly, how many times did we see him spring a forward for an odd man chance, or spring a forward in an open lane that created, you know, a rush opportunity? That's the type of player he is. And when you look at how much success this Canucks team can have with the skill players they have in transition, it can be a perfect fit to get Bo those chances. And we know how good Bo is once he gets the puck with speed coming through the neutral zone, entering into the offensive zone. He can do a lot of damage in that sense. Same thing with Pettersson. Same thing with Brock Besser. I am very high on Nate Schmidt and what he's capable of doing on this team. Defensive zone coverage at times in his own end, well, that could be an issue. We have seen a little bit of it. But the overall offensive output he can provide for the team, how much better the transition game becomes. And they look a lot faster when you have a guy like him on the back end. Everything I've seen from Nate Schmidt has been very encouraging so far. And Izzy, I mean, this guy's only going to get better as well. So it's going to be a lot of fun watching this guy play on the Canucks back end.
Sportsnet Satyar Shah joining us on air. Sat, before we get your prediction for tomorrow's Browns Chiefs game, really quickly, we really interesting result last night between the Senators and the Leafs. Mm-hmm. Just quickly, we've got a rematch tonight. It's the early game on Hockey Night in Canada. I'm not sure I thought the pressure could have been ramped up any more on Toronto as quickly as it has been, but just your takeaway from the first two games of the Leafs and the seeming pressure that is mounting on them and the organization.
The new Leafs, same as the old Leafs, right? I mean, that's kind of the general takeaway from what we've seen so far. Incredible talent. They can dominate for stretches, but man, do they get running around their own zone, right? I mean, talk about not knowing what you're doing in your own end. And in theory, getting Zach Bogosian on a cheap deal, hey, he's a guy that can separate the man from the puck. He plays physical. You know, there's something there that maybe can help the team overall. But defensive positioning-wise, he has some troubles. You saw him get turned around a few different times. They have a lot of young players in that back end that have a lot of potential, but they're also very green in how they defend in their own zone. And then you look at their bottom six. Their bottom six has talent. Their bottom six has push. But outside of Zach Hyman, who knows how to play on their own end in the bottom six? And I like Wayne Simmonds as a dude and as a guy that plays in your bottom six, but he's not an impact player anymore. And he's definitely not a two-way impact player. Outside of throwing, you know, the gloves and getting to fight him now and then, throwing some big hits, getting some goals, and providing some, you know, secondary scoring depth, he's not a guy that makes a difference as a two-way player for this team. How is this team significantly better as far as their defensive game goes? That has not been shown yet through two games. And tonight, though, I wouldn't be surprised, though, guys, we see Toronto just wax Ottawa, right? I mean, they're going to be motivated. I can see their offense getting loose. Maybe they win the game 5-2, 5-3 or something. I can see them really getting going offensively. But all the questions we had about the Leafs through two games persist. And if they can't figure that out, well, they're not going to be a team that runs away with this division. They're making the playoffs, no doubt about it. They're a top four team in this division. And ultimately, they might win the division. But if their game so far continues, and it's a lot like we saw last year, they're not running away with anything. There's not going to be a huge separation between the top team and then maybe fourth team that makes the playoffs. And if Toronto is not a dominant team or not clearly the best team in this division in terms of results, yep, then it's going to be a real interesting division this season. And the point I made last night on the program with Walks and Bick was Toronto is better than Vancouver. Toronto has more depth than Vancouver. Nobody's denying that. But the gap's not that big between the two teams, right? Like, if we're looking at how big the gap is, it's not like we're comparing Vancouver to Tampa. Like, Toronto's a really good team, but this whole notion that they're this upper echelon juggernaut just doesn't really compute right now.
Yeah, they have not shown that through two games. That's been the most surprising thing to me. You know, like, I think the Canucks have looked all right. You know, like, mm-hmm, there hasn't been any major concerns for me through two games. But the Leafs, even the game they won against the Habs, I did not think they looked particularly good. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that develops.
It is, and the pressure is going to be so high. You're right. You already made a coaching change last year, so you can't really make that switch this season, no matter what happens, right? So Sheldon keeps the guy. But if these issues persist, what shoe drops in the offseason? We talk about the Canucks having spent a lot of capital, and we all know they've spent a lot of capital on the roster that they have. But so has the Leafs, right? I mean, this is a team that we talked about for years. And I have a lot of time for the Leafs. And I actually love their plan. And I like the people that are in charge of the organization. But if we're being honest about and evaluating what their plan was and how far they've come since that plan was put in place, it has been an abject failure because they're making the playoffs and they're an exciting, talented team. But they've certainly not even come close to reaching the goals they set out. They're supposed to take advantage of their ECL. They're supposed to, you know, go all in early on when you have the chance and have success. Well, haven't won a single playoff round yet. They traded a bunch of capital already. They traded a bunch of players already. What else do you have to play with here? Yes, you drafted well. Yes, you got in some free agents, you know, on cheap deals and some projects from Europe that have potential, that could figure it out. And I love the Rodin Amarov pick in the draft this year. So there's a lot there for the team. But if you look at it from capital spent and from what they're – goal was in the execution, they failed their plan. They've absolutely failed their plan so far. And if they fail their plan again this season in that market, something's going to give.
And they'll be cheering all the way across this country if that does happen, not just because of the Canadian division, but even if the Leafs were in their regular Atlantic division, fans in Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton, Winnipeg, Ottawa, Montreal would be really happy to see the team fall flat on its face. We'll get you out of here on this, Sat. Obviously, you're a Browns fan. I think last weekend was probably, I don't know, I don't want to speak for you necessarily, but top five moments in your life, a tough challenge coming up this weekend with Pat Mahomes. Where are you at with the mentals? Where are you at mentally with the Browns heading into the matchup?
Giddy, happy, you know, the endorphin rush. I did not know you can have an endorphin high for a week based on a sporting event. Who knew? That's where I'm at based on the Cleveland Browns winning their first playoff game in like 25 years. The dopamine in my body is naturally very high right now. So I'm feeling really good about the Cleveland Browns and their chances actually against the Chiefs. There's zero pressure, right? Ultimately, chances are they don't win the game. But the fact that I get the opportunity to watch my favorite football team play one more playoff game going up against the Kansas City Chiefs, only two games away from potentially being in the Super Bowl, I am beyond delighted. No matter what happens tomorrow, I am proud of this team. I'm excited about the future of this team. And I feel good about being a Cleveland Browns fan. But just humor me for a second.
Yeah, there's you haven't been able to say that for a while, Seth.
Ever, right? Like, I haven't said that forever. Like, I've talked myself into things before, you know, like, hey, this team might be sneaky good as it might win six games this year and not be a one-win team. Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, Braylon Edwards, absolutely. Or Josh Gordon early in his career when he was good before all those issues started coming back for the poor guy, right? We see him right now having problems again. He can't stay in the NFL. And I pray for the guy and I hope he's going to be okay just on a personal level. But the point being, the things that we were most excited about was individuals at certain times. Braylon Edwards, Josh Gordon, Derek Anderson getting hot for a year or whatever it is, right? I mean, those have been the things we've been excited about. But now, this might be sustainable. There's something you're building towards. And just looking at how they're going to KC, confidence is massive in everything. The confidence on that team is going to be high. You're getting Denzel Ward back. You're getting your head coach back. Your old line is going to be healthier again. You have other guys off the COVID list coming back. Your offense is humming all of a sudden. Your run game's strong. You know how to control the clock. KC hasn't played in a few weeks. Again, I'm not saying the Browns are going to win this football game, but there's a chance that they're in this football game with a chance to win it in the second half. And if you put yourself in a position to have a chance to beat the Chiefs, who knows what happened? You know, like, so I still think the Chiefs win, guys, but I actually have a lot of optimism the Browns might pull the upset. So that's where I'm at.
Well, man, I wish them luck. I know that you'll enjoy it, but do enjoy it. We'll enjoy listening to you later today right here on Sportsnet 650 with All Day Canucks pregame. So thanks for taking the time to hop on a bit early and talk some puck with us today. And enjoy the Browns. Enjoy the Canucks tonight as well, Satin. Thanks as always, buddy. We always appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. Always love jumping out with you guys. And you guys are lucky. Chelsea won and somehow found a way to beat Fulham despite having an extra man. If they would have lost that match, I may have just gone into hiding until 6 p.m. So really thank Chelsea for pulling through in an unconvincing way, yet with a victory.
Yeah, that's an insight into Sat Shah. Browns fan, Chelsea fan, and an authority on the Canucks at this point. So yeah, thanks a lot, Sat.
Thanks, boys. Have a great weekend.
All right. Sat Shah from Sportsnet 650. As mentioned, he'll be hosting the pregame show right here, Sportsnet 650, all day coverage ahead of Canucks and Flames continues. All right. Coming up next, we will wrap up on air for this week. It's Israel Fair. It's Alex Blair. And you're listening to the official home of the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
This is Sportsnet Today, and you're on air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair. Now here are your hosts, Israel and Alex.
Wrapping up on air for another week, Israel Fair, Alex Blair live, Sportsnet 650 for 2 hours every Saturday.
Should know we're back on Calgary 960 next weekend after the divisional NFL playoffs. So if you are podcasting us in Calgary, we will be back on next Saturday from 1 till 3.
Yep, this is correct. Thank you for pointing that out, Alex. been a fun experiment for us. But the last 2 weeks, because of NFL, only on live in Vancouver. Both of us have our takeaway from the interviews this week. And thanks to Richard Deitch and Satyar Shah for joining us on the show. Our takeaways are NFL related. We talked to Richard, who is American. He lives in Canada now, and he works for The Athletic and Sportsnet in Toronto. But he spent a lot of time in the city of Buffalo, New York, a place that I have been to a couple of games back when it was still called the Ralph Wilson Stadium. I saw the Bills beat the Patriots, actually, the Tom Brady Patriots. They had a huge comeback, and it was the first time that I had seen a game in Buffalo, and it was unbelievable. And I'm a Seahawks fan. I've been to dozens of games at CenturyLink, or I guess it's Lumen Field now, down in Seattle, and that also is quite an experience. But there is something about a game in Buffalo. It's a completely open stadium. It's in this really kind of idyllic part outside of Buffalo. Everyone thinks Buffalo and thinks hard industry, Buffalo wings, and it's kind of a grimy place. That's not where the Bills play. The Bills play basically just outside of a neighborhood with like white picket fences and stuff. But then you show up there on game day and there are people doing cake stands at 9 a.m. in people's driveway. There is a huge parking lot surrounding the stadium, and it's a truly, truly worthwhile experience if you're just a sports fan or if you're a fan of another NFL team to go down there and hang out, because Bills fans are known for just wanting to have a good time for the most part. The last 20 years or so, they have mostly relied on having a good time outside of football. But, as Richard said, this is a team that's brought a lot of passion and excitement to Buffalo the last couple of years, this year in particular, as they are in position here to move on to the AFC Championship game. But what did you make of what Richard sort of painted the picture of what it's been like to be a Buffalo Bills fan for the last little while and what this run could mean to them?
Yeah, it was a bit of a reminder. Like you, I've had the opportunity to go down to Buffalo for a couple of games during my almost decade in Toronto. And like you said, the stadium is not downtown. It is in the middle of this neighborhood. As an Arsenal fan, actually, it somewhat reminded me of Highbury.
Yeah.
In the sense that it was just sort of, as you said, you sort of drive in. It's a lot like the Coliseum in the sense that there are large parking lots, but almost everybody who lives around the stadium, they just sort of open up their yards and you can park your car on their lawn. And there is it doesn't take you very long to realize the cultural significance of the Bills to the Buffalo community.
Yeah.
And, Buffalo is a blue collar town. It is part of the Rust Belt. Mm-hmm. In some ways, I mean, the last few years I've noticed a significant difference within the city. It's rebuilding itself to some degree, but there was a long period of time there where the best days were behind Buffalo and they lived for their sports teams in a way that I'm not even sure, Vancouver can relate to, Toronto can relate to. It was,
we just talked to Satch Shah about Cleveland, right?
Yeah,
I mean, Cleveland's basically the same and also kind of that same level of futility until LeBron totally was able to bring a basketball championship. But these are hardscrabble places. People are so passionate about their teams. And in Buffalo, as you said, like every home game, and this is where, and yes, it's football, so there aren't as many games. So every game obviously just takes on more significance. But the 8 regular season home games are basically, and they're a Sunday, so it's not a holiday during the week, but they take on the feeling of like 8 Christmases for the people of Buffalo.
Yeah. Like I'll tell you, like the last game I went to Buffalo, I don't even know who they played. I'll be honest with you. Like I had gone down the night before to watch the Sabres and the Rangers play. And I had a huge, I had a buddy who was in town from Kamloops, BC, huge Bills fan. And so I had agreed to go to the game with him and another buddy. And I was thinking like, I'll have a couple beers before the game, then I'll just cut it off and I'll still, I'll be okay. By the time the game's over, I'll be able to drive back to Toronto tonight. I won't need a hotel. By 8:30 in the morning, I called the hotel and was like, I'm going to need an extra night, because it was honestly like being on another planet. Like it was somewhat scary at times, but the level of passion was incredible. And my takeaway was just Richard sort of bringing that to life and sort of the reminder. And I know for Canucks fans, whether, you know, whatever generation you're in, you know, 1994 has like a really incredible significance for you, or 2011, or maybe both.
Yep.
And what you sort of forget is that the Buffalo Bills went to the Super Bowl 4 consecutive years in the early 90s, and they couldn't get it done. Like, imagine 2011, but times that by 4, you know, like to get right there. And in some ways, like, you know, that sort of paints a picture. And you think about it, when that run ended, they basically haven't won a playoff game since, I think it's 95.
Yep. Yeah, so, it was. And they made the playoffs in the late 90s a couple times. But it was sort of a bit what we saw with the Canucks. But as you said, on a bigger scale, because they made the Super Bowl 4 years in a row. They have the Hall of Fame players. They've got the great structure, the organization, the head coach, the GM. Everything's perfect. Then they start to slide a little bit. So they still make the playoffs, but they're not making the Super Bowl, but they're still winning a playoff game. And then a couple of years after that, they're in the playoffs. Obviously, you know, the Music City Miracle. And then it's about a decade of not being relevant. Obviously, we know that that decade, given their division, it was the Patriots' domination of the sport, but then especially that division, which is what made the game that I, the first game that I saw in Buffalo, where the Bills came back to beat the Patriots early in the season, one that was so memorable because it was, you know, it may as well have been Christmas, because they beat the Patriots. They didn't have huge expectations going into that year. And they've had some ups and downs, the Ryan Fitzpatrick 5 or 6 games that got people excited, but this is legit. This is for real. Josh Allen has been a guy that basically been criticized since he was drafted as just having a big arm and not being able to do much else than that. His first season in the league, there were some flashes, but this year, as I said, outside of a couple game blip in the middle of the season, he's been phenomenal. He had better numbers this year than Russell Wilson. He was an all-pro second team pick, tied with Patrick Mahomes, who we generally agree is probably the most talented person to ever play quarterback, and deserved the nod over Russell Wilson, who heading into the season was an MVP favorite, and all of that stuff. We saw how that ended up playing out. I might break that down a little bit later, but like, Josh Allen deserved that nod over Russell Wilson, which says a lot about the season that he had.
Yeah. Well, and you know, Richard also touched on the fact that it is a little unfortunate that due to COVID, the fans in Buffalo won't be able to be at the stadium tonight. But 5:15 tonight, Ravens, Bills, you know, for that community, there's a lot on the line. And, anyway, that was just my takeaway, you know, as Richard had spent, you know, a good portion of his university years there. And it's a place that both you and I have spent some time in. It's a significantly big game for one of those markets that, has unfortunately had a really long run of bad luck. And it's a community where sports matters more than, you know, most communities that have NFL teams or, you know, other teams, whether it be NBA or NHL. What was your takeaway from today's interview as well?
Yeah, I think the Nickelodeon broadcast thing was really interesting. I didn't watch it live, but I was watching the game, the Saints-Bears game at the time. And just the reaction to the broadcast was universal praise. People just thought it was so much fun, and it's not necessarily the Nickelodeon part of it that's interesting. That was the platform, and therefore there was a Nickelodeon twist to the game, but it's a larger conversation about sort of the conservative nature of sports broadcasting, where we have seen, I would say, the example that comes to mind first and foremost, and of the 4 major men's sports league in North America, the NBA is definitely the most progressive when it comes to social justice and things like that with its players, but then also with its entertainment product. So we've seen some things with broadcasts that have been a little bit different. What I think this is closer to is Monday Night Football trying comedian Dennis Miller in the booth, or trying columnist from PTI Tony Kornheiser in the booth, and getting sort of mixed reviews on that, and then just going back to a really straightforward, typical broadcast. Even though they have times, I know one thing that sticks out to mind for me was Jimmy Kimmel coming on and basically hijacking the broadcast. And it was hilarious. It was great. It was really funny. But people sort of said, you can maybe do that for a quarter, or you can do that for a half, but you cannot build out a schedule where Jimmy Kimmel is the reason that you're watching Monday Night Football. So every time that there seems to be a step forward in, let's try something. And for me, it's not even, I want necessarily want change, or I have a problem with the sort of classic traditional broadcast. I'm just kind of interested in seeing, is there something else that we can do? Last weekend, it was a Nickelodeon twist with touchdowns being celebrated with slime and certain kind of funny comparisons to players, to cartoon characters and stuff like that. But that was the platform. And I thought it was really interesting to see the praise that it received. And the fact that, as Richard said, he expects that this is something, because of the number of people that were interested in it, beyond just the critical praise, 2 million people watching on that channel, but Major League Baseball. I mean, he brought up the example that Disney owns the Star Wars properties. They have a lot of baseball properties. What's stopping them from doing a Wednesday night baseball broadcast that has a Star Wars theme to it? We already see some teams, you know, have Star Wars nights and things like that, and bringing right. it to the broadcast. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the broadcast. There's still people that are going to want the play-by-play guy, the color analyst, and a general, straightforward, unbiased broadcast from a national perspective. And it does seem like there's an audience for something different. And I thought that was pretty fun.
Yeah, no doubt. And it's not aimed at people like you and I. You know, like, I think we are of a generation. We are of an interest for the traditional broadcast. But if you are someone that has kids, you understand that kids and this next generation that's growing up, they do not consume sports the way that we did growing up. The traditional sports broadcast is maybe on in the background, but they have another screen in front of them. There are way more options for them. And it's been interesting to see, you know, the Nickelodeon broadcast last week. I know the Leafs and the NHL and Sportsnet have done sort of a kids broadcast the last two seasons, I believe, where they actually held a Leafs game in the afternoon.
Right.
Totally aimed at children. The broadcast had some sort of younger components to it as well. I think they actually had, you know, a young child co-hosting the sidelines with Christine Simpson. These are things that broadcast companies are going to try because they need to engage that next generation. Otherwise, there will be a significant audience drop off. And in some way, we are seeing that. You touched on it a little bit earlier, but I want to get your sort of final thoughts on
you want to cut me open.
Well, we talked about the Seahawks last week, and
yeah, I got to say, you were right. You ended up being right all season.
Well, no. And it was, you know, I'd kind of kept a loose eye on the Seahawks. I hadn't seen a ton of the Rams, but from what I had read and what I had seen, something just seemed off. But give me your takeaways from what was, you know, a fairly disappointing end to a season that started with a lot of promise.
Yeah, really disappointing. One of those games where you feel like something needs to change, but you look around the roster, you look at the coaching staff, you look up in the front office, and it's really, there's not an obvious answer. And Seahawks ended up parting ways with offensive coordinator Brian Schottenheimer, who'd been in the job for 3 years. And that seems to be like, that's what's going to be the big move. But the Seahawks, they've traded a lot of draft picks over the years. We've been talking about it throughout the show, where you look at Pittsburgh with Sidney Crosby and how they've mortgaged their future to try to win now. Seahawks obviously did win a Super Bowl early in Russell Wilson's career when they had the best defense of the best defense of the league that season, and arguably one of the top 10 defenses that has been built of all time. They have not gotten back to that level. What made the game against the Rams disappointing was that the Seahawks were supposed to open up offensively. The Rams have a great defense, but they looked stuck in the mud. It was a pretty frustrating watch, and a lot of question marks about, okay, did we overshoot what the ceiling was for this team? That's the big question. And I think there's a lot of those conversations going on right now. I think the point that you want to make before we close the show is we're talking about the Toronto Maple Leafs. We're having the same question with them. Did we overshoot, or did they overshoot what their ceiling was before having all the pieces together? Like, that's where the Seahawks are at, right? It's been very easy the last few years to say Russell Wilson is a top five quarterback. He's great. Open it up. And what the questions that we've had over the last little while was, you know, maybe there's no doubt that he's a great quarterback, and I expect him to be a Hall of Fame quarterback at the end of the day. But the way that things are constructed, did we overshoot this ceiling a little bit? And we're having that question a little bit with the Toronto Maple Leafs too.
Yeah, well, just quickly before we leave the Seahawks here, just how concerned were you with Russell Wilson? Because he started out on fire, and there was all this MVP talk through the first couple of weeks. And then it just, like, it almost felt like he was exhausted or mentally fatigued, or there was something, because he just never seemed to get it back on track. What did you make of that? How concerning is that for you going forward?
We've seen it a couple times in his career where there were times, there's one season in particular where the offensive line wasn't very good and he was clearly affected by it. He was skying throws, which we've seen, we saw a little bit toward the end of this year. The offensive line wasn't a huge problem this year. So it was more on him. And then the second part of it was he had a season where he was clearly injured and he looked like the way that he looked to finish out this year. And by all accounts, he was pretty healthy, as healthy as a football player can be. So that's when those concerns come, because there's not that obvious thing to point to and say that there was an obvious reason or excuse for why he played the way he did. The game plan sort of got away from them, and they had a soft schedule heading into the playoffs, and that didn't help them as much as the defense did improve, because the defense ended up being a middle of the pack D instead of one of the worst in the league.
All right, looking ahead to what we're both looking forward to, and from a quarterback whose season's done to one who's currently on the field, what are you looking forward to from Aaron Rodgers today as the Packers host the LA Rams?
Yeah, I love watching Aaron Rodgers. It's about as fun as I've had watching any athlete in any sport. He's on that list for me. Just great command of the quarterback position, the ability to be creative, to be flexible, to use his athleticism from beyond the pocket. I grew up in the generation where it was Tom Brady and Peyton Manning, great players, among the best to ever play the game, but very much pocket passers. Aaron Rodgers brought a bit more flair, and I always really enjoyed watching him. And this is another run here for the Packers, a possibility as the number one seed in the NFC, home field through the NFC playoffs, to add to his legacy. And that there's that component of it. And then, yeah, I just love watching the dude play. And I'm glad that he gets an opportunity here to stunt a little bit on this level.
Give me your NFC championship dream matchup. You want the Packers versus the Bucks or Packers versus Saints?
I'm going to say Bucks, just because of all the things that would go into that. I'd be happy with the Saints, but if it's Brady and Rodgers in the first season in Tampa, that's pretty much ratings gold, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm with you there. I like that matchup as well. For me, what I'm looking forward to is the finale of the Tiger Doc tomorrow night, HBO. Enjoyed the first episode. If you haven't read the book by Armin Katayan and Jeff Benedict, who we've had on the show before, it is a phenomenal read. The doc goes into a number of the areas, but not quite as deep and not quite as expansive as the book. But nonetheless, it will be a good cap to what should be a great Sunday with Browns Chiefs at noon. We got Bucks Saints at 3:40. I'm a big 60 Minutes guy, so I'll be watching 60 Minutes at 7 o'clock, and then we'll have a little Tiger Doc at night. So that's what I'm looking forward to this week, and also just a little bit of patience with the Canucks. Like, I'd like to see them get a couple games under their belt. I'd like to see JT Miller return before we sort of, you know, give this team a report card.
Yep, Canucks and Flames will play tonight. No JT Miller, but the rest of the crew will be playing against the Flames on Hockey Night in Canada. Coverage continues right here, Sportsnet 650, once we're done. And that's it for us. Thanks to our technical producer today, Joel Gaudette. Thanks to Richard Deitch and Sat Shah for joining us. If you missed those interviews, check them out on the podcast. Coming up next, it's Hockey Fight with Brendan Batchelor and John Cullen. We'll be back next week. This is On Air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair, and you're listening to the official home of the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.